So, with a title like A Day of Reckoning, that sounds a little ominous, to say the least. So, I want us to think about if you had to prioritize a hierarchy of sins as to the worst and those not as bad, what would your list look like? What would you, if you were given a pad and a pen or pencil, and you were told you're not leaving this room until you prioritize sins. Top of the list, worst. Bottom of the list, not as worst. What would it look like? Where would you start? How do you know? What is the worst? What are the worst sins on earth? Don't think about it too hard. Don't want any damage. Is it murder? Is it sexual sin? Is it a quantity issue? It just depends how bad it is. There was just another school shooting. Children were hurt and killed. Is that the worst? And there's plenty of examples of various kinds of perversion going on around us. Is that the worst? Well, first we need to determine from whose perspective. How do we make such a determination? Is it based on how it affects us personally as to whether we determine it's the worst? Or is it based on what we think we're not guilty of? Is it from man's viewpoint or is it from God's viewpoint? Just think through the Ten Commandments. No other gods before me, no idols or false images, no misuse of the name, remember the Sabbath, honor parents, no murder, no adultery, no stealing, no lying, no coveting. Well, we know this is a broad categorization encompasses other things. There are subcategories that could be calculated into there. Is it somewhere inside of those things? Is it one of those? Where do you start? If you were God, what would be the most serious sin on your list? Now, I know none of us are, but sometimes we act like we think we are. And if you were, what would you put? Well, when you think about the Ten Commandments, the first four are relational with God Himself. No other gods, no idols or false images, no misuse of the name, remembering the Sabbath, particularly in relation to Israel, as we've looked at that. The next six are relational with other humans. Honor parents, no murder, adultery, stealing, lying, coveting. Do we think that our relationship with God is more important than our relationship with one another when it comes to the kinds of sins that are there? Just think about what do we normally think? You know, usually murder is right up there. That's kind of a bad one. You can go to jail for a long time for that. Used to be you could lose your life for it, but that's becoming less and less the case. Well, the Bible indicates that God is our first priority. That ought to tell us something. The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Matthew 22:37. So we know what the greatest commandment is. That puts God at the highest priority, and love your neighbor as yourself, which is right up next to it. So they're pretty close. So what is the greatest sin? If that's the greatest commandment, what's the greatest sin? Is it the unpardonable sin of blasphemy to the Holy Spirit? Which really comes down to rejecting this Holy Spirit's prompting to trust Christ when you put it in practical terms, or attributing the work of the Spirit to something other than the Spirit. our inclination is to assign the greatest sin status to those things that harm the most humans, especially children. Isn't it? Isn't that what we normally think of? But God seems to be more concerned about what negatively affects our relationship with Him and then others. Again, we tend to assign the greatest sin status to those things that most negatively affect us or that seem most offensive to us. But when we look at the whole of Scripture, we see that the sin of pride gets a great deal of attention from God as a most serious, if not the most, in some way. But we tend to excuse that one as not that serious, don't we? I mean, when you look at the sin lists, is it part of the deadly dozen or the filthy five or whatever other listing you make? So, one commentator said, a major motif in the Old Testament theology is found in this text that we're going to be looking at. Pride and ambition are humanity's besetting and most devastating sins. Idolatry is seen as an expression of this drive by which man seeks to exalt himself. So we want to think about the text that we're going to be looking at today, and we want to evaluate our list of sins in relation to what God's list includes. Our text last week concluded with a couple of transitional verses. Those verses sort of wrapped up the previous section but also introduced the next section. So we need to be reminded of what these verses were. Isaiah 2, verses 10 and 11 say, "Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and the glory of His majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled. The haughtiness of men shall be bowed down. And the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day." When we look at the section that we're going to be looking at today, and a part of that, verses 10 through 21, are understood as a poem on the nature and results of divine judgment. And basically indicates this: the Lord is exalted over man and the world, verses 10 through 17, which can be broken down to the fact that the Lord is exalted and man is humbled, and the demonstration that the Lord is exalted and man is humbled. And so that's God, the Lord God is exalted over man and the world, and man is humbled in the process. And the Lord is exalted over idols, 18 through 21. The fact that the Lord is exalted over the idols and man, verses 18 and 19, and the demonstration that the Lord is so exalted in the rest of that those verses 20 and 21. So that is just kind of an overview of a way of looking at that text. But the key that we need to remember here is that the self-exaltation of man is the basis for judgment, and that has far-reaching implications on all of society. And so it's the exaltation idea. Are we exalting ourselves over God, or is God exalted over us? So when we think about a day of reckoning, several things to think about. The first is a day of reckoning for pride. Now, it was interesting, and I may have seen it before, but I was struck by it. When I was looking for some photos to put with the concept of pride, and I looked, you know, did the Google thing and looked, and what do you think I found? Rainbow pictures. And that was all. Pride. And I thought pride was a sin. And here you're flaunting it. That should tell us something. shouldn't it? Verse 12 through 14. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. And then it's going to give us some imagery, thinking in terms of poetic imagery here. Upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains, and upon all the hills that are lifted up. Those are examples of things that are lifted up. Is this just an indication of some material things that have some elevation to them, or is it an indication of some identification with those things, is something to think about. Then the next verses 15 through 17, upon every high tower and upon every fortified wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish and upon all the beautiful sloops, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. So that's the clear picture here of the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty. The loftiness of man will be brought down. The haughtiness of men will be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. It kind of sounds like pride is an issue that the Lord has with people. So, we want to think about, what is personal pride? Well, it's an inner attitude of independence from God. It's certainly the opposite of loving God with all your heart, soul, and mind, that we saw was the greatest commandment. So if you're not doing that, then you're loving yourself with all your heart, soul, and mind, and you're lifting yourself up. Pride is indicated as an object of God's judgment time and time again. In this case, referencing the day of the Lord, which is often a very broad eschatological category, and sometimes it's talking about a specific event that is anticipated maybe a little bit nearer, but we need to think about that thought as well. But in this case, the loftiness of man will be brought down in relation to the exaltation of God, seeing him as he is and seeing us as we ought to recognize where we are in relation to him. Pride is an inner attitude of self-importance. Now, our natural inclination is toward pride. It is a natural means to help us feel good about ourselves, and we've been told in the age in which we live, time and time again, in our educational system in particular, that we need to feel good about ourselves, and you need to be exercising some element that involves pride in the process. And it seems to be that pride is usually at someone else's expense. I'm lifting myself up so that I'm above someone else in some way. And if we do that in relation to God, what does that do? Well, I'm more important than God is what it communicates. And God doesn't seem to take kindly to that reality, because it's not a reality. It's only in the reality of our own thinking. So we need to be careful about how we view ourselves in relation to God, because pride always leads to trusting in self over trusting in God. So if that's what we're dealing with, then we need to think about, well, how is pride manifested? What does it look like? Pride has an outward expression in monuments and accomplishments. When we think about man, what man has been able to do, we can think about all kinds of things. Historically, the examples that are in the text point to anything that man exalts in, whether man made it or not. In reference to mountains and hills and tall trees and that sort of thing. I'm reminded of John chapter 4, where Jesus was talking with the woman at the well, and she asked, "Where should we worship?" She said, "You worship in Jerusalem. We worship in Mount Gerizim." She was up in Samaria. And Jesus said, "Well, that's not the real issue. It's a relational thing with God." And how easy it is to get distracted on some of those kinds of things. And I already noted that the reference to the cedars and the oaks and the mountains and the hills may be symbolic of people who identify with them or make use of them. And it certainly doesn't deny the value or the beauty of those things or even the things that man has produced. It's a matter of whether or not that ought to be what we trust in or what we think identifies us. And yet it does. And you notice the photo here is of a city with its great buildings and all of that. And you just think through all of the different kinds of monuments to man that there are. Now, there are some good things because they help us think back on history and all of that. But what does it say? Is it saying that man is great? We've accomplished great things. We've put people on the moon. We've circumnavigated the globe in many different ways. And we can dig deeply into the earth. We can go high up into the sky. We have just done so much. Aren't we great? There is a universal assessment of mankind's pride. That's what this text is communicating. And it's a judgment that relates to all who live on the earth. It's not just talking about the Jews, but it's talking about the Jews and their neighbors and everybody else. It's a warning for all people of all time. Because there's a danger in prideful exaltation that relates to all people of all time who are relying on their own accomplishments. It's also an indication of local and universal judgment. And Dr. Martin communicated a couple of paragraphs here. Let me just note this because it helps us to think through some things regarding how Isaiah and many of the other prophets communicated. He says, throughout this section, chapter 2, 6 through 4, 1, and many others in the book of Isaiah, there is an interesting interplay between the judgment which the Lord will inflict on the nation by the Assyrian and the Babylonian captivities. So that's the local, that's the close by, and the judgment that will come on Israel and the whole world in the last days just before the millennium. So there's an interesting interplay. Probably Isaiah and the other prophets had no idea of the lengthy time span that would intervene between those exiles and this later time of judgment. It has been explained in the past, and you may recall it, when you are standing looking at a mountain range and you see there's a mountain protruding here and then behind it another one and behind it another one. And what you can't tell from the vantage point that you have is how much distance there is in between those, which can get you into trouble if you have to get from point A to point B and you don't know how much there is in between and you don't know whether you have the resources to get there. But in this case, it's a matter of seeing these peaks but not seeing what is in between. And then he continues, though many of the predictions in chapter 2, verses 10 through 21 happened when Assyria and Babylon attacked Israel and Judah, the passage looks ahead to a cataclysmic judgment on the whole world when he rises to shake the earth, which is noted in both verse 19 and 21. So we need to recognize this close and far view that frequently zooms in and then zooms out again throughout the book. And sometimes they're right close together. And it's not till we kind of stand back and see that there's a local event that's coming sooner, and there's at other times a universal element that is going to be far off and come later. But we need to recognize that that is often the case. So there's the matter of pride, a day of reckoning for pride, and then the day of reckoning for idolatry as well. But the idols he shall utterly abolish. They shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. And then continuing, verses 20 to 21, in that day, talking about, again, the day of the Lord language here, in that day a man will cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made each for himself to worship, to the moles and bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the crags of the rugged rocks. These are the places that this gold is going to disappear to, that's found in these idols, is the idea. Again, the same language, from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily. A little bit of emphasis there and a restatement of that concern for coming to terms with the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. So idolatry vividly indicates man's misplaced trust. Idolatry is essentially a visible God substitute. I need something with some tangibility so that I can focus on this. Oh, it's just to help me think about God. But then I get focused on this and I forget about God, is what happens. And sometimes it doesn't even get to that point. And an idol can be anything that takes our attention away from God, any kind of object of devotion. Because we have been distanced by time and culture from the kind of idolatry that was a part of the world in the time of Isaiah, we tend to dismiss idolatry as something that doesn't relate to us, and we're okay. But all we have to do is think about things around us that are tangible distractions from our devotion to God that we tend to trust in or have affection for. So that it may be more of a concern than what we realize. And it can be because of our focus on our pride and elevating ourselves and taking away the emphasis that would be focused on God and our trust in him to these other substitute things. Idolatry is based on ascribed human value. Things that we may see as having some value, like monetary things, like silver and gold, or things that have our devotion, our affection, because we both idolize people and things. I mean, you think about how many people are focused on celebrities, how much attention they get. They are idolized. That's a word we use. And that can be a problem as well. Not that we have any of that kind of problem. I'm just saying those people out there. Right? You can think about that. Idolatry would be directly addressed by coming judgment. That's what's communicated in this text. The coming judgment will result in displacing idols. In the devastation that's going to be a part of the coming judgment, idols are going to be destroyed in the process. And those who are the ones who are trusting in those idols, they will try to hide from the judge. And whether they are actively trying to hide the idols in the process as well, that's a possibility too. The coming judge will display the Lord's majesty. There will be a force of it that will be such that it will bring terror on those who are opposing him. And when you think about the judgments that are communicated in Scripture, whether it be the Assyrian captivity or the Babylonian captivity or the many other variations that have taken place historically, or whether we're thinking about the ultimate day of the Lord, which is yet to come, if you don't get a sense of the majesty of the Lord as he is coming to bring judgment, then you're missing something. Because it tells us that he is the ultimate judge. He is the Holy One of Israel, as has been communicated. And we have to deal with him ourselves. Then verse 22 is kind of a summation in a sense. It says, "Sever yourselves from such a man whose breath is in his nostrils, for of what account is he?" That's essentially an exhortation to stop trusting in man. It's like, what is man that you are mindful of him, as is communicated in the Psalms? Man's life comes from God. He should be the one we trust in, not in those who have his breath in them. Human beings have no value as objects of trust. Why do we trust in others? That doesn't mean we can't trust other people. We have to in order to function, but we don't trust in them. We trust in the Lord. Idolatry is but a result of man's self-glorification. Human beings will never bring about Israel's glorious destiny that God is predicting. We're not going to bring that to pass. He will, in his time, in his way. He is the only one that can. And he can see that those who don't trust in him will be taken care of accordingly. So this verse, like verse 5 earlier, is another transitional verse, and it bridges the preceding proclamation of universal judgment, which is the broader picture, with more specific judgment, and that's where it kind of gets narrowed down. So we need to think about that transitioning now to some more specific things relative to the nation. So a day of reckoning for resources. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 3, "For behold, the Lord of hosts, takes away from Jerusalem and Judea the stock and the store, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the skillful artisan and the expert enchanter." All of the people that you have been trusting in, either militarily or politically or just in some other way generally to function in society, all those people that you are trusting in, they are going to be taken away. You were trusting in man. That's not the way. You were trusting in your resources. They are going to be removed. So physical resources will be removed. There will be a day of removal of essential supplies, the things that they depended on. There will be a time of severe deprivation as a result. And we know what happened with regard to Jerusalem when it was ultimately taken, of how severe the deprivation was, the extent to which they went as they were unable to get out of the city. And they were in desperate straits and were eating their own children, etc., which is just what had been predicted, which is awful. Human resources will be removed. There will be the removal of those who give leadership. There will be the removal of those who give service. The effects of this judgment will be far-reaching. It will affect the food supply, the basic provisions, the essential people, And we know that this literally happened in 586 BC, also happened again in 70 AD, and will happen again in the tribulation period. It's a day of reckoning for leadership. When you remove those people, that will be in effect, but also maybe talking about some of what they were dealing with at the present. It says, I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. The people will be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall be insolent toward the elder, and the base toward the honorable. Well, we can relate to some of that going on in our world. Don't have to look far. Don't even have to think far on that. There will be a lack of qualified leadership. And this was a historical reality in the case of Judah. In particular, some of Judah's kings began very young. Manasseh began at age 12. He reigned for 55 years. Amon began at age 21, reigned for 2 years. Josiah began reign at 8 years of age and reigned for 31 years. Jehoahaz started at age 23, and he reigned for 3 months. And he was also known as Shalom. It's helpful to remember that many of these kings had more than one name. And it's not surprising when you think about how many different languages there were around there, and the fact that it's not unusual for people to take different names when they take on leadership. So Jehoahaz was the son of Josiah, and he was also called Shalom. And then Jehoiakim, he was 25 when he began to reign. He reigned for 11 years. He was also known as Eliakim. He was also the son of Josiah. And then Jehoiakim, or Chin, depending on how you like to pronounce that, he began age 8. And he reigned for 3 months and 10 days. He was also known as Jeconiah. He was the grandson of Josiah, the son of Jehoiakim. And then Zedekiah was age 21, and he reigned for 11 years. He was also known as Mattaniah and was the son of Josiah. So three of Josiah's sons and then a grandson reigned in succession for 11 years, 3 months, 11 years. Well, and Jehoahaz before him was 3 months. So we have this 3 months, 11 years, 3 months, 11 years thing going here. And then there were many of these last ones in particular were just plain incompetent, as has been noted. But there's also a general principle. Not only was this a historical reality, but it's a general principle. There would be a dearth of qualified leadership. The reference to children here specifically is referencing boys, and that was the case with these. And princes refers to commanders or rulers. The reference to babes speaks of immaturity or capriciousness or impulsiveness and instability, and that fit those leaders as well. So there was a historical reality, but also an issue that was going to be problematic in the future. All of this indicates a lack of leadership and respect. And we don't have to look real far to think about how things are in our day. Do we have the kind of leadership that is qualified and capable, regardless of what age one may be? Isaiah 3, verses 6 and 7 says, when a man takes hold of his brother in the house of his father, saying, you have clothing, you be our ruler, or you have a cloak, a garment. You've got the right outfit for it, so you might as well be the leader. And let these ruins be under your power. Probably talking about the captivity had taken place and then what's left. In that day he will protest, saying, I cannot cure your ills, for in my house is neither food nor clothing. Do not make me a ruler of the people. It's like, there's nothing left here. I'm not willing to proceed with that. So there would be a lack of willingness to lead. The most minimally qualified person will be sought to lead if someone has the right clothes or the right look. You look like a leader. Why don't you do it? If someone is close by and has a pulse, might grab them then. I know that's happened in the church before. That's not what's supposed to happen. There should be some minimum requirements. This minimally qualified person will be unwilling to lead because there won't be much there left, is probably the idea. Because such a person doesn't have the vision to lead. The situation is so bad, it seems hopeless. And they may lack the resources, or at least say they lack the resources, so they don't get pulled into it. Sometimes people are unwilling to lead for the right reasons, because they're not qualified or some other matter. But sometimes people are unwilling to lead for the wrong reasons, because they have other interests or they don't see the big picture. But leadership would be a problem. And this dearth of leadership is going to be part of the judgment. And it's not too distant in the future. At the time when Isaiah was speaking to these people. And what's going to happen is, as a result of all of that, the normal elements of social structure are going to break down. And I think about, you know, the hazard of social structure breaking down. That's serious. And that's where we are today in our world. The social structure is breaking down. The institutions that were put into place by God are being systematically dismantled, redefined, so that what do we have left unless we come back to the truth? And the issues continue to come up as to, well, when you redefine marriage, and then you redefine gender, and then you redefine family, I mean, and then you have to redefine and redefine because you've taken things apart, and then you, it's like, what do you have left? And I can't help but wonder when I see some of these things that are talked about here in the situation that Isaiah is talking about, and then you just make just a little teeny tiny application to our present time, and you think, well, Isaiah, are you talking to us as well? Should we be concerned? Absolutely we should. Then a day of reckoning for rebellion. For Jerusalem stumbled, and Judah is fallen, because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord, to provoke the eyes of his glory. The look on their countenance witnesses against them, and they declare their sin as Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to their soul, for they have brought evil upon themselves. What do you think about that in our context? Boy, that hits home. The cause of this judgment on Judah was basic rebellion. They resisted the Lord in word and in deed, and their defiance was directly against the Lord. It was a provocation against the Lord's glory. I can't help but think about those who are serving in the political arena, who are believers, who are getting castigated because of their belief. Just thinking about the vice president currently, the number of times that those in the media in particular have just said horrible things just because he's a Christian and a committed believer. And it's directly against the Lord. So they resisted the Lord in word and deed. They resisted by willful attitude and open declaration. The things that were once in secret are now put in your face of the resistance, and it's seen in their faces. It shows their attitude. It's an open defiance like Sodom was. And we have much the same kind of attitude and examples and illustrations going on today with these pride parades, etc. And it goes on and on. And there's no question as to the guilt. All we have to do is apply these to our own nation. We're just as guilty as they were. And I wonder, is our situation even more serious? There's a sense in which it is, because we know more. We have more revelation. We have more history. We have a greater breadth of understanding. We have access to biblical truth like no people ever had in all of history. Are we not more accountable, given the rich heritage that we've had and have been losing systematically with greater and greater acceleration going down? It does cause one to be a little bit concerned and to think that we have brought evil upon ourselves, is the way it's stated. Then verses 10 through 12. Say to the righteous that it shall be well with them, for they shall eat the fruit of their doings. That's a little glimmer of hope. There will be some. Woe to the wicked, it shall be ill with them, with him, for the reward of his hands shall be given him. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. Some concerns expressed here. A clear distinction is defined by one's responses. The righteous will experience the results of their actions. And the righteous would be defined as those who are rightly related to God by putting their faith in Him. And the result would be of being righteous is that you're doing the right things. That's kind of in the word that's there, because the right relationship should lead to right behavior. But it does indicate there will be a remnant that will continue. But the wicked will experience the results of their actions as well. And that's an ultimate accountability. The wicked ones are noted by their behavior and by their rejection of God. And they will heap upon themselves the results of their rejection. Like the New Testament says, you will reap what you sow. That picture will commence. And then the application for Judah is a warning of their danger that they're facing because of inept leadership and inadequate leadership. The reference to children and women here indicates those who are immature and unqualified to lead. Don't take it personally. I'm just telling you that's what the text is communicating. This is the emphasis of the context that's here. The nation's faulty leadership will lead them down a dangerous path of destruction, away from blessing and toward cursing. And it's a sobering reminder of the significance of leadership in a nation. Notice how many times that was referenced. And you wonder, in light of that, why don't evangelicals take voting and participating in the political process as more important and take it more seriously than they do? Now, there was a greater response this last time, but so often they've just not participated because they think, well, that's material, that's not spiritual. But this seems to suggest that there's a responsibility, because we have a part in our process. We have opportunity to impact our political world. Sounds like we ought to have some part in it. We know that God ultimately orchestrates things and that he is leading things, but he also uses people and he uses us. I mean, he can direct the heart of a king, but he can also direct us if we're responsive to that. So we ought not to just be passive. We ought to be actively involved to the degree that we are able. God holds governments accountable. He also holds individuals accountable. So what are some concluding thoughts? Is the Lord being reasonable in condemning pride and idolatry and expecting good leadership? Is he asking too much? Is that a reasonable thing for the God of the universe to expect? The one who has given us what his expectations are in the Ten Commandments and many other places? It's not like he didn't tell us, even though many in our current day are trying to say, well, we don't want to be exposed to that. Is the Lord mean and unreasonable to expect obedience from his own children? When you were raising your children, did they ever tell you that you were being mean and unreasonable when you disciplined them? Maybe. Were you being mean and unreasonable? Hopefully not. But God isn't mean and unreasonable. Depends on how you see God. Is he just like us? Or does he have ultimate authority as the creator of the universe, the sustainer of all that is? If he is really God, then all people must properly respond to him. Are we righteous? Are we wicked? How are we related to him? Have we received the provision of salvation through Christ? That's what it comes down to. That's the issue. We need to keep our pride in check. We need to acknowledge that he is the God of the universe. We need to see that he is the exalted one and we are not. We are accountable, whether we like it or not. And the reality is that a day of reckoning is coming on all. And it's for all. Are we prepared for that? We have the truth. We know what the response is. Are we living in the light of that truth as his children, as his obedient children, so that we can keep in check those things that would distract us from the relationship that he wants us to have?